You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 20th of December 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London, with me, Phil Hahn, and Georgina Godwin.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll look at what can be done to restore stability to South Sudan.
The UN mission in South Sudan will try and extract unarmed UN personnel from Akobo while reinforcing the base in Akobo with an additional 60 troops from Malakal.
Also ahead, we'll be setting the day's agenda with Middle East expert and RUSI research fellow Shashank Joshi. Shashank, what do you have for us today?
We're going to be looking at a US-India row, the never-ending saga of Iran sanctions, and Nelson Mandela's training by Mossad agents.
And all of that coming up with Shashank a little bit later on in the programme. But is it the worst musical in history? We get the inside story on Spider-Man, Turn Off the Dark.
2 million people have seen it, you know, by a whole lot of, you know, ways to measure things. Yeah, it was anything but a flop.
So all that, plus we'll play some music as well. And we'll also flick through this morning's front pages. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
But first, let's catch up on the headlines with Barney Burnham.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. President Obama has warned that South Sudan is on the brink of civil war. He issued the warning after clashes in the capital, Juba, spread around the country. It's estimated that 34,000 people have taken refuge at United Nations compounds. On Thursday, three Indian peacekeepers were killed in an attack on a UN mission at Akobo in Jonglei State. UN spokesman Farhan Haq.
In Akobo, where civilians have gathered, Lunor youth have reportedly forced an entry into the UNMISS temporary operating base to reach those civilians. Fighting took place, and we have yet to ascertain the situation. We fear there may have been some fatalities, but can't confirm who and how many at this stage. The UN mission in South Sudan will try and extract unarmed UN personnel from Akobo while reinforcing the base in Akobo with an additional 60 troops from Malakal.
85 people have been injured, four of them seriously, after the ceiling of a London theatre collapsed during a performance. Over 700 people, including many families, were in the Apollo Theatre watching the popular play The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. The audience was showered with masonry and debris. Chief Superintendent Paul Rickett of the Metropolitan Police.
We know that a number of items of masonry have fallen down from the ceiling, causing different injuries, and you'll hear about more than the casualties from the ambulance service in a moment. I would like to stress that at the moment there is no evidence that this has happened as a result of a criminal act, but the investigation is in a very early stage and we will keep an open mind. Most of the casualties are walking wounded, all are conscious and breathing, but we understand that people will be concerned and possibly try to contact loved ones.
European Union leaders have agreed to cooperate more closely on making falling defence budgets go further. Austerity-hit EU countries have slashed spending in response to the financial crisis. EU leaders discussing defence at a summit for the first time in 5 years called on member states to work together to spread the cost of developing expensive military equipment. They also pledged to launch projects to develop a European drone by 2025 and to look into a new generation of government satellite communications. Herman Van Rompuy is the European Council president.
Overall, working together has its clear advantages. It is partly about rationalizing investment so that European countries can have cutting-edge technologies like next-generation remotely piloted air devices or drones, or next-generation satellite communications. We took also decisions on both of these, as well as on air-to-air refueling and means to better counter cyber attacks.
The German Chancellor Angela Merkel has welcomed the Russian President Vladimir Putin's decision to grant amnesty to Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who's been in jail for more than 10 years. Speaking at the end of the first day of the EU summit, Merkel told journalists she was pleased with the decision and that she'd always pushed for the release of the former oil tycoon. Mr. Putin said he'd received a request from Khodorkovsky to be freed on humanitarian grounds as his mother is ill. He says he'll be granting him a pardon soon. New York City Council has voted to add electronic cigarettes to the city's strict smoking bans in the latest of many anti-tobacco measures to be signed by the outgoing mayor Michael Bloomberg. Only weeks after New York became the first major city to raise the legal age for buying tobacco to 21, the council voted 43-8 on the ban that will add electronic cigarettes to the city's Smoke-Free Air Act. If the mayor signs the bill, it'll become law in 120 days. A court in Los Angeles has ruled that the actor Ryan O'Neill can keep an Andy Warhol portrait of his late partner Farrah Fawcett, who died in 2009. The University of Texas, which was the Charlie's Angels star's alma mater, had sued O'Neill over the ownership of the 1980 portrait after she bequeathed it, her art collection, before her death. The court ruled 9-3 in favour of O'Neill. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much to Barney Burnham. It's 6 minutes past the top of the hour. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House, live from Studio One here in London. It's time now for us to set the day's agenda with a look at some of the top stories over the course of the next 24 hours. And joining us here in the studio is Shashank Joshi, a research fellow at the Royal United Services Institute here in London. Welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Shashank, lovely to see you as always. Shall we begin with this escalating diplomatic row that's happening between India and the US?
Sure. The US and India have a strategic partnership. These are big new allies in Asia. And now their relationship looks like it has suffered rock bottom with a huge rift over the arrest of an Indian diplomat in New York over charges that she not only underpaid domestic help, because of course so many Indian diplomats, like middle class families in India, have household help, maids, cooks and so on, but also filed a false contract. She was arrested, she was strip-searched, put in a cell, and the Indians are furious, saying she had diplomatic immunity, how dare you do this? I think there's an added concern here, not only because India is a state that's very sensitive about its status, about how it's treated by the West, but also because this is a female diplomat. And I think there are some interesting gender dynamics going on here in Delhi. You know, how could you possibly strip-search not only a diplomat, but a woman as well?
And this, of course, coming up to a year's anniversary of that terrible, terrible rape in India.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's some sort of under the surface, those tensions haven't really gone away. But what's interesting here is that, you know, this relationship has taken off in the past 15 years. They've signed a nuclear deal. The US is selling huge numbers of arms to India. They've got a common concern in China. And it only takes one tiny little diplomatic incident to do this. What's also very interesting is how the US justice system works. You've got prosecutors, attorneys who are elected and therefore make a name for themselves by prosecuting these cases, a practice that's completely alien to us here in the UK. And I think the State Department is desperate to put all of this into a box and say, just let her go, calm all of this down. And the Justice Department is saying, hang on a minute, no, the rule of law, we're not going to let her go. This is a question of crime.
And to be fair, there could be some that would argue that the Indian government did overreact to this situation. You know, the scenes that we saw a few days ago of them removing security barriers in front of the US embassy, that was quite a startling move.
Absolutely. They also blocked import licenses for alcohol for the US embassy, threatening the liquidity of the US embassy's Christmas party. But what I found most interesting was some Indian politicians threatening, if you enforce your laws, we'll enforce ours. And don't forget, homosexuality is illegal, so we could penalise and target the partners of US diplomats, which I thought was a particularly low blow from Delhi.
India took particular exception to the statement issued on Wednesday by the federal prosecutor in Manhattan, who is Indian-born, actually.
Yeah, he was virtually called an Uncle Tom in the Indian media. They said he's got to prove he's more American than the Americans, and they picked up on his ethnicity. And he's a showboating Indian-born American who's trying to make a name for himself. A very well-known prosecutor prosecutor who's done a lot of such cases. But I think the Indian media was really annoyed at his suggestion that the victim here wasn't the diplomat, but the maid who was being underpaid. And they thought this was an absolutely unacceptable statement.
And we have seen some moves from nearly the highest levels of the U.S. State Department apologizing for the event, saying it went a bit too far. How do you see foreseeing this moving forward? Will this diplomatic row resolve itself quite quickly, or do you think this will only get worse in the next couple of weeks?
I think they realize the damage this is doing to bilateral relations. They will find a way to solve this. It'll probably end up, as these cases do, with the diplomat being whisked out of the country back to India to pursue her career somewhere else.
Shashank, let's move on to your next topic, and this is the Iran nuclear deal and the new sanctions bill. This story rumbles on.
It does, doesn't it? And, you know, we thought we were in the clear. The US-Iran Geneva Agreement, as we all probably know by now, says that the US can't impose further sanctions. You know, fair is fair. Iran freezes the program, the US freezes sanctions. But the problem is, of course, Congress has its own mind about this, and Congress, again and again, is pushing back against the White House's pleas, which are saying, look, don't topple this diplomacy. Just hold off on sanctions for a while. You now have a bipartisan move, that is from Democrats and Republicans, to impose new sanctions. Now, the congressional people behind this say, look, it's conditional. The sanctions only get imposed if the diplomacy doesn't work. And the White House is saying, you're tying our hands. We can't negotiate like this. So it's a very interesting tussle between the executive branch and a Congress that is always trying to stick its head into foreign policy.
And the White House chief spokesperson, Jay Carney, came out yesterday in a statement saying that the White House and Obama would veto any bill that would get passed in Congress. So the buck really does stop with Obama on this.
It's worth saying how incredible that would be. We have not had the presidential vetoes occur a lot, but Congress, of course, can overturn a veto with a two-thirds majority in both houses of Congress. That has not happened since the Reagan era in foreign policy, when Congress overturned President Reagan's unwillingness to impose sanctions on apartheid South Africa. So what we're seeing is new terrain here. The president can veto a bill, Congress can override it if they think he's being unreasonable.
But no signs that they have the two-thirds majority that they potentially
need. No signs yet, but if it looked as though the president was being unreasonable and blocking what everyone saw as a reasonable bill, you could see an attempt at overruling this. But I mean, this is just an unprecedented level of interference, and it shows you, I think, how hamstrung Obama is in his foreign policy.
But if that did happen, and if he was overruled in Congress, you know, Obama still has, what, 2 years left in his term in office, he would be completely, you know, the reputation of the presidency would be so weakened.
Absolutely. Well, some would say it already has been. You know, look at the Syria strikes. They were called off for a host of reasons, one of which was Obama knew he didn't have the congressional support. There was just too much opposition. He chose to go to Congress, but Congress could have blocked him as well. So I think on a number of issues, what you are seeing is a new era in which U.S. foreign policy and the presidency is really being dragged down by hostile domestic forces. And unless Obama gets a grip and can confronts this, it's going to complicate, as you say, what is a pretty long time left in office.
Shashank, let's move on to your last story, which I think is going to make headlines everywhere. It's a startling story coming out of Israel.
That's right. So it's Haaretz, the left-wing Israeli newspaper, saying it has top secret documents from Israel's archive showing Nelson Mandela received training from Mossad agents in Ethiopia in 1962. Now, he didn't know they were Mossad agents, but reportedly he expressed interest in the Jewish underground Palestinian movements that existed before the foundation of the State of Israel. He expressed interest in communism, and we, of course, know he had an interest in that. But it's absolutely remarkable, because for so long, people have been saying, well, you know, Mandela was resolutely against Israel and his occupation of Palestinian land, that Mandela's own experience is a shining example against Israel. And what's interesting is this is going to cause a lot of people a lot of headaches, thinking about Nelson Mandela having received arms and training from agents of the Israeli Secret Service.
But that relationship was a very fragile and delicate one, wasn't it? Netanyahu didn't even go to the funeral.
Incredibly delicate. And of course, Israel extended extensive support to the apartheid regime. There was a certain sense of embarrassment there. And I think the story really reflects the time at which it occurred. You know, Mandela and his compatriots would take help from wherever they could find it. And this was true across Africa. So I'm not sure we should judge them overly harshly here.
Shashank Joshi of Rusi, thanks very much for coming on the show.
Coming up after this very short break, as the attacks in South Sudan become graver, we ask what can be done to quell the encroaching violence.
Are you tired of overcooked and overrated culinary trends that never quite hit the spot? Cookery books that leave a bad taste in the mouth? Fed up of being spoon-fed half-baked ideas on the next big thing? Then tune into The Menu with me, Markus Hippi. Every week we introduce you to the world's top makers and shakers, cocktail creators and the best bread makers as we uncover gourmet street food, big-time baristas and wily wineries.
We're making porchetta sandwiches. It's a roast pork belly with some Italian seasonings. Just really simple, salt, pepper, fennel pollen. Simple, tasty.
I think food off a grill really just tastes exceptional. It's the sort of thing I like to eat, you know. Lamb, chicken, even octopus, squid always tastes good.
This is the show that discovers how coffee can change a country and how chocolate can make us live longer, all in the search for exciting local food producers and the most original entrepreneurs.
You don't make business lunches here. You come usually alone or with somebody that you know very well, because it's homey style. You have to feel familiar with someone to eat in such a place.
That's The Menu, every Friday at 1900 hours London time.
You're back with Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Georgina Godwin. Next, though, we turn to South Sudan, where now an estimated 34,000 people have fled to United Nations compounds in and around the capital, Juba. Yesterday saw the key northern city of Bor fall to the renegade soldiers, and now three Indian UN peacekeepers have been killed near the eastern border with Ethiopia.
Salva Kiir, the president of Africa's youngest nation, alleges troops loyal to his sacked deputy, Riek Machar, are responsible for the attacks, while the military also said that Major General Peter Gadet had mutinied, taking with him some troops. Well, it's unclear if troops loyal to Mr. Machar are working together with those of Major General Gadet, or if, in fact, they are the same soldiers.
It is in this context that the United Nations fears a civil war between the two ethnic groups, the Dinka of President Kiir and the Nuer of Machar. Well, joining us here in the studio to discuss this further is James Schneider. He's the editor of Think Africa Press. Welcome to the program, James. We'll get to you in just a second, but let's get the latest on the ground there in South Sudan with Monocle's Tristan McConnell, who joins us now from Nairobi. Tristan, overnight, the deaths of three UN peacekeepers there. It's a very dangerous turning point in the conflict.
Well, I think it is it's significant in the sense that it shows that these rebels are not being, put off by the presence of UN peacekeepers. What happened in this particular case is they were chasing the different tribe members into a UN base and killed the peacekeepers whilst there. And it really shows us that the UN peacekeeping mission is not in a position at the moment to really protect the civilians as this fighting escalates, notwithstanding, of course, the 30,000 to 40,000 people who have taken refuge in various bases around Juba, but they'll be feeling less secure after the news of this attack on a peacekeeping base in Akobo, which is in Jonglei State, yesterday.
And yesterday, when we spoke to the UNHCR, they were saying that some of the refugees were planning on returning home. Clearly, that's now no longer an option.
Certainly not. I mean, it does look from reports on the ground in South Sudan that the conflict is spreading rather than being contained, and there are some unconfirmed reports earlier today of fighting in Benue, which is the one of the main oil-producing states up in the north of South Sudan, sort of on the border with Sudan, and that is certainly worrying because it strikes at the heart of the southern economy and can only make matters worse. I mean, the real threat here is that we have a political fight underway between the president and the former vice president, and both of those characters can rely very heavily on ethnic blocs for their support, and so a political fight is very quickly becoming a tribal one, and that can spiral out of control very fast indeed.
Tristan, thanks very much for joining us from Nairobi. Tristan McConnell there. Let's turn now to James Schneider, who is the editor of Think Africa Press. He is in the studio. James, welcome to the program. One of the key things, this is a very new country, South Sudan, and one of the key and perhaps one of the most important elements is having a military which supports the government in place. That obviously does not seem to be happening with these two different political parties, two political figures, each trying to get their own handle on the military.
Well, this is what will happen when you have to fight to win your country. So the government and the military are essentially the rebel force which won, or you know, which won independence in the war with Sudan, or with the civil war within Sudan. So the separating the army from the government, separating the government from the ruling party, has been pretty much impossible.
We're seeing now not just soldiers, but also youth joining in. I mean, this is looking like a huge ethnic fight and not a military one in any way.
That's a really important distinction. So the attack on the UN in Jonglei State was not by soldiers, it was by Nuer youth. And this is important when we look at how the situation is evolving, because we can say that as it starts, it's primarily political, that there is obviously an ethnic dimension, but the ethnic situation was more complicated and was not just Dinka versus Nuer as the thing begins. But as violence continues, and as people respond to violence done to them, and as difference becomes increasingly instrumentalized, we start to see the fault lines hardening into this ethnic thing, which is extremely, extremely worrying. And the fact that, you know, these are people just going and doing violence on their own rather than being necessarily directed is really troubling.
And both ethnic groups want control, of course, of the very oil-rich region of Abay. Mm. How central is oil and money to this fight?
I mean, it is in the same sort of way that power is, but it's not over specific bits of oil, or we want to control this specific area and so on. But yeah, I mean, everybody who is involved in this fought for the independence of the state. And now there's a payoff. Now there's money coming in, now there's oil, and now it's time to be divvied up. And part of the problem in South Sudan is so many of the former fighters, or still in the military, feel that because they won independence for their country, they're owed something, which means that the kind of development of enterprise, whether that be public or private, and things like that, have been pretty slow in developing, whilst people just taking what they can get because they feel it's owed to them has been pretty high. So when you have that situation, a huge number of soldiers knocking about the place, or former militants knocking about the place, lots and lots and lots of arms, and it's very easy for just a couple hundred guys with some arms to go into the bush and regroup and then start some kind of rebellion. I mean, there were other rebellions already taking place within South Sudan before this started. It's a very, very difficult situation to be policed at the best of times, and now when the state is essentially in turmoil with itself, it's so much worse.
President Barack Obama's warned that South Sudan's on the precipice of a civil war. Is this the Rwanda moment? Is this the time to be firmly on the right side of history? Will there be intervention?
But intervention for who, on what side, and how? I mean, in sounding the alarm about the potential for civil war, I think that is probably correct. I think that is correct, actually. But it's far too difficult to say, right, well, now we would send in 10,000 troops and the 10,000 troops would, you know, support this group versus that group, or they would, etc. What you could do is beef up the UN force, give it a more robust mandate to protect civilians, allow, you know, create zones of exclusion of fighting where civilians can go and receive humanitarian aid, and use this as a kind of temporary support for the population whilst regional actors and international actors try to come to some kind of settlement. But it's very, very difficult to try to transpose some idea of what we think happened in Rwanda onto this particular situation.
James, one word answer for me now. Do you think South Sudan will survive 2014?
Yes, but yes. Depends what you mean by survive. Sorry, that's not one word. But close enough.
Excellent stuff. James Schneider, the editor of Think Africa Press, many thanks for joining us on this program. After this very short break, we'll be speaking to Zenya Dormandy on the new American foreign policy. Now, all this week, we've been featuring some of the essays featured in our December-January issue by speaking to those behind them and to explore the themes within. Well, today we turn to U.S. Program Director at Chatham House, Xenia Dormady, who takes a look at American interventionism, or the lack of, in today's geopolitics. In light of an about-face turn on Syria, Xenia tells Monocle's Alad John that the new American foreign policy leaves the rest of the world uneasy, confused, and at risk.
This is the question that everybody's asking. America's intervention has gone up and down. So there are periods post-Somalia where America stopped, post-Vietnam where America really kind of did pull back. And the question I think that most people are asking today is this another temporary pullback post-Afghanistan, post-Iraq, where Americans are weary, others are weary, and America's temporarily going into this kind of hibernation mode, and then we'll come out again? Or is this a permanent, long-term state of affairs? My own personal view, we won't know for another couple of decades, but my own personal view is this is a longer-term phenomenon. This is not a, this is partly driven by the temporary, by the war weariness, but it's actually a longer-term phenomenon where the numbers just don't work. The fact that America, it gets berated for acting as much as it gets berated for not acting. You know, America can't win. So there are an awful lot of people who are saying, why should we be spending our resources for a public good that nobody thanks us for?
What do you see taking, kind of filling the vacuum of the, in the wake of the America's kind of, let's say, less active foreign policy? You talk of a fear, an international fear that America isn't going to step up to the plate.
Exactly. So an awful lot of America's allies, and I mean, I look to Asia and Europe as great case in point, an awful lot of America's allies have really relied, depended absolutely on the United States being there. Libya is a great case in point. You know, the French and the Brits under a NATO umbrella led the Libya operation, but very quickly they didn't have the resources, they didn't have the equipment to get it done. They needed America to engage. Mali, again, the French needed America. The same is true in Asia. If you talk to the Japanese, you talk to the South Koreans, their defense policy, defense strategy depends on America being there. And there are a lot of them. You know, I was in Japan earlier this year, at Singapore, you know, very much are now starting to ask the question, is America always going to be there? Is it as reliable as it once was? And there's a big question mark after that. And so people are beginning to respond to that. The question for me ends with, if not America, who or what? The obvious question is to say the Chinese, you know, perhaps the Russians again. I don't think that's the answer. I think that the nature of today's challenges are that they cannot be dealt with unilaterally. America is a necessary but not sufficient actor. It's going to be multilateral groups, ad hoc groups.
It brings me on to my next point. Perhaps in the wake of a kind of single bastion of leadership, as we were discussing before we came on air, is it the unilateral groups, the United Nations Security Council, which obviously are under a lot of strain and spread very thinly, that may actually take on the role of international arbiter?
I don't think it's the UN, much as I wish it were, but the UN has shown itself to be a very hard to implement things through the UN. Again, NATO, you can make an argument, but again, it's not even NATO because many of the countries in NATO don't want to act either. The future, and it's not in the next year, but it's probably in the next 5 or 10 years, we're already seeing it happening, is the rise of ad hoc groups. What's the problem? Let's bring together a coalition to deal with that problem. And then let's move beyond it. That you're already seeing that. So the Iran negotiations are the P5 plus one. Mm. The North Korean negotiations are the 3+3. You're already seeing the creation of these ad hoc groups. And they do require leadership. And that leader might be the United States. It might be France. It might be the US. The UK. It might be China. It could even be a non-state who takes leadership to get things done. In the environmental space, I don't see the states stepping up.
Many would say that America's less active foreign policy, as we've termed it, would say it's not such a bad thing. Many argued that the lack of intervention in Syria through use of lethal force was actually, on the balance, the better outcome.
So I'll say this as a former diplomat. When I was in certain parts of the world, people would say, former American diplomat, people would say to me, why is America not doing blah, 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 blah? And why doesn't America get out of? And in the same sentence, it would have two clauses, why isn't America doing this? And if America wanted to, they could force X to act. And at the same time, but you're also being too nosy, you're being too, you know, engaged, get out of our hair. The trouble is that people have gotten so used to the idea of America acting that they're not used to America not acting. And there's this expectation, everybody wants America to do exactly what they want. There isn't this consensus. And in that sense, America cannot win. We America, just antagonize by acting, because for some it's too much and for others it's too little.
The mechanism of something like a unilateral body like the United Nations, although they're hampered by the fact that, say, if America wasn't willing to contribute troops or act underneath the Responsibility Act without Security Council authorization, America's hampered either way.
So America is going to get wrapped on the knuckles, whatever it does, until the world gets used to the fact that America isn't always going to be the lead, that everybody doesn't need to follow America. So, I mean, look at the challenges today, and almost, these are global challenges or these are regional challenges, Middle East peace process. Why is the expectation that America is going to take the lead on that? You know, why doesn't the Arab League take the lead on that? Why doesn't other, the OIC take the lead on that? You know, there's the expectation that America will lead. People are going to have to get used to the fact that that is not always going to be the case.
Is America comfortable with not leading, though?
That's a really good question. Right at the moment, there are different strains within the United States. There's the isolationist strain, there's the engagement strain, the kind of neocon historically. There's the kind of neorealist strain. There is no one consensus. I personally don't believe America has a choice. The nature of the challenges means that America cannot do it alone. And America does have resource constraints just like everybody else.
And that was Xenia Dormandy of Chatham House talking to Alad John. In the next half hour of the programme, we'll take a look at the international press with Aisha Spears and speak to the co-writer of Spider-Man the Musical and author of a new book on the controversy that surrounds it.
But first, here is Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Thanks, Phil. President Obama has warned that South Sudan is on the brink of civil war after clashes in the capital Juba spread around the country. It's estimated that 34,000 people have taken refuge at United Nations compounds. 85 people have been injured, four of them seriously, after the ceiling of a London theatre collapsed during a performance. Over 700 people, including many families, were in the theatre at the time. European Union leaders have agreed to cooperate more closely on making falling defence budgets go further. They've pledged to launch projects to develop a European drone by 2025 and to look into a new generation of government satellite communications. Russia's President Vladimir Putin has signed a decree pardoning the former oil tycoon Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who's been in jail for more than 10 years. Mr. Putin said he'd received a request from Khodorkovsky to be freed on humanitarian grounds as his mother is ill. The New York City Council has voted to add electronic cigarettes to the city's strict smoking bans and the latest of many anti-tobacco measures to be signed by the outgoing mayor, Michael Bloomberg. Once he signs it, the bill will become law in 120 days. A court in Los Angeles has ruled that the actor Ryan O'Neill can keep an Andy Warhol portrait of his late partner, Farrah Fawcett, who died in 2009. She'd bequeathed her art collection to the University of Texas before her death, and the university had been suing O'Neill over the ownership of the 1980 portrait. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much to Barney Burnham, who'll be back at the top of the hour to update the news for us. Well, now we turn to Broadway and discuss a very contentious musical, Spider-Man, Turn Off the Dark. Terrible reviews, lots of delays and injuries made the production the most talked about show in Broadway history. With a price tag of $65 million, it was a very daring spectacle indeed.
Did you see it? Have you seen it?
I haven't seen it. I heard it was pretty bad, though.
I heard it was quite bad, but they would have that really great song, the theme song, right? Spider-Man?
Can you sing it for me?
Spider-Man.
Oh, no.
Anyways, Glenn Berger co-wrote the script, and he reveals all the backstage shenanigans in his new book, Song of Spider-Man. That's it. The inside story of the most controversial musical in Broadway history. While Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to him about the impact of the production.
New York City, let's get your freak on! Glenn, before we talk more a little bit more about the show itself, do you think the musical Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark has made its mark in pop culture history?
Yes, I think it did manage to do that. It definitely blazed brightly for a period of time. I think it'll definitely go down in history. At the moment, has lost more money for its investors than any show in history. But, you know, I think for a number of metrics, it will be long remembered.
Let's go through a little bit some of the controversies. Why was it so controversial? Can you go through some of the reasons?
Well, you know, it got a lot of attention very early on. I've been trying to get my head around it myself, and all I can think of is, you know, near where I live in this Dutchess County Fair that happens every summer, and there's this mad science exhibit where you have this sort of guy in a lab coat beginning to put all these chemicals in, you know, one beaker, and my kids who go every year are sort of on the edge of their seats, you know, wondering what's going to happen, you know, if it's going to turn purple or make bubbles or explode. And, you know, I think that a similar thing happened with this show. You had all these different sort of potentially unstable compounds. You know, you had Julie Taymor and Bono and Edge, and you had Spider-Man, and then you threw in another chemical, you know, make it all a musical. And, you know, I don't think anybody really knew what was going to come out of it. It was going to turn purple or you know, actually explode. And I think when it, you know, began to sort of bubble over, you know, in the autumn of 2010, I think people realized, oh, this could be quite a sight. See the bird fall from the
Tell us, what was your involvement with the play, Glenn?
Well, yeah, in the spring of 2005, I was hired to be the co-book writer. Once the original book writer was Neil Jordan, the filmmaker, and he was dropped from the project after he turned in an outline that Julie Taymor thought was a little too cinematic, not theatrical enough. So Julie and the producer at the time, Tony Adams, they figured, well, we'll get a new writer, but this time we'll make him a co-writer, and Julie will be, you know, also listed as a co-writer, and she'll sort of steer the narrative. So I came on board and generated an outline at the end of that summer, and then the following year, after Marvel had approved it, started writing the script and, you know, stayed on the project until the very, very end.
Was there anything good about the final product? I mean, because I read as well that, I mean, once you're not, it is one of the top 10 grossing musicals in Broadway history as well. Correct me if I'm wrong.
I'm not sure. I mean, it has grossed over $200 million. And, you know, I know, I mean, listen, since 1857, which I think was the first, you know, long-running Broadway show, there's been thousands and thousands of Broadway shows. Only 108 have had more than 1,000 performances, and Spider-Man was one of them. You know, and over 2 million people have seen it. You know, by a whole lot of, you know, ways to measure things, yeah, it was anything but a flop. But in other ways, you know, like, do the investors get their money back? The answer would be no. And I get caught up sometimes myself in thinking, oh, yeah, that didn't turn out well at all. But then, you know, when I look at, you know, my own kids who saw the show a couple times, or, you know, any child in the audience, you know, their eyes are just alight with what they're seeing. And, you know, and you realize, oh, you know, for many, many, many people, it was a thoroughly enjoyable night out. So there's that.
That's Glenn Berger, author of Song of Spider-Man, the inside story of the most controversial musical in Broadway history, speaking to Fernando there. Well, coming up, our correspondent Michael Booth meets the seaweed farmers of Denmark.
Culture on Monocle 24 is untouchable. Go on, just try and do it. Try and grab a handful of the top-grade cultural radio that we're dishing out and see if you can touch it. Well, exactly. Luckily, though, you can feel it. Feel the passion of the unusually button-bright presentation.
It's a fantastic contrast, and it's one of those ones that ask you to look at the brushwork, to look just at the canvas.
Feel the craftsmanship in the breathtaking live Midori House sessions.
You know, I consider myself an entertainer, so I'm really about communication. I'm not really about expressing myself so much as trying to communicate with people and bring them to tears or bring them to laughter or what have you.
Feel the lovingly hand-stitched production, and most of all, feel the love of art.
It's there, and it's true, but it's really only a small part of his work.
Feel the love of fiction, feel the love of film, feel the love of music, feel the love, generally.
It is the most extraordinary collation of works that you would never normally see together.
Why not invite me round? Culture with Robert Bound is a well-behaved house guest and a joy to entertain.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with Phil Hahn and me, Georgina Godwin. It is 40 minutes past the top of the hour. Now, we should probably all be eating more seaweed.
I agree.
Really?
I love seaweed.
Well, it's good for us.
I sometimes just have raw seaweed.
Do you?
Well, no, it's actually... It's in the packets, but it's not like I go to the beach and eat seaweed.
That would be kind of weird, grazing on the beach, yeah. The thing is, it's sustainable and all 10,000 types of seaweeds are, in theory, edible. So far, though, the farming and harvesting of seaweed on a commercial scale has been pretty much limited to kombu and nori in Japan.
But off the east coast of Jutland in Denmark, Rasmus Bjerregaard is pioneering seafood farming in Europe, while Monocle's Copenhagen correspondent and food writer Michael Booth went along to find out a little bit more.
These are just pieces, actually. It's not whole plants. And what I'd like to show you here is how we induce the spores on the seaweed. Because what we do here is we are manipulating the plant to believe, actually, that we are in wintertime. Because in wintertime, they produce spores. But we induce spores. We need spores all year round because we have a production here running all year round.
How do you convince seaweed it's winter?
Yes. We convince it, you see, we have the light here, it's set to 8 hours of light.
There's so strip light suspended above the tanks, yeah.
Exactly. And so we are manipulating a light regime so that it seems to be winter. And you see, here you see the result of it.
Yeah, Erasmus is just holding the seaweed up to the light, and through it you can see in the middle some darker spots, which are, I guess, the spores, right?
Exactly. There you see the spores. And once we've developed these spores, and this side here, you'll be able to see it about 1 million spores, I guess.
So a million spores, yes, in about 20 square centimeters.
Exactly. So you have about, potentially at least, 1 million plants here. Wow. In your hands. So we rinse it, and then we put it into the fridge 24 hours. And after 24 hours, we take it out of the fridge again. And then we put it into a bucket with water. And once we do it, within 5 minutes, we have millions of spores swimming around. Yes.
What, swimming?
Swimming around. It's, you can see it's like semen, more or less. So it's, yeah. And then we have our spore soup. And then we can start our process of detaching them to the lines.
Rasmus explained that the spores are then encouraged to attach to lengths of rope in yet more light-controlled tanks. Then they're taken out by boat off the coast and left in the water to grow for 2 years. Then the seaweed is harvested out at sea, brought back to land and sun-dried. He sells the bulk of his seaweed for animal feed, but demand is increasing from human customers. Afterwards, we went into his office where he gave me some seaweed to taste and he explains how he uses it in his kitchen.
So we have a big tub of flakes of kombu in front of us. Mmm, MSG. It's a flavor I get. Very savory, yeah. Salty.
Yeah, yeah, sure. This is sun-dried, so that it enhances the taste, because if you sun-dry things, the polyphenols get turned into tannins. So that
like in tea?
In tea, exactly. Mm. And I have a customer in Germany, and he uses it in tea mixtures.
Well, wait a minute, we're in Denmark. Where do you get enough sun to sun-dry your seaweed?
You see, that's the problem. First of all, the problem is we can only harvest in May in order to have the finest quality. And then we are depending on sunny days in May. So we are actually doing that for human consumptions, as food. But our main focus is now feed because of that, because otherwise we'll not be able to handle these quantities. I put it into each time I make pastry or bake some bread. I put that in, not the powder, but the flakes.
You put these flakes, the whole flakes in.
Yeah. Or if I make meatballs, I do the same. And the texture is much better, and the taste in itself, it doesn't have this seaweed taste, but the overall taste is better.
It boosts it.
It boosts taste, the overall taste.
Yeah.
It boosts the taste of meat, boosts the taste of bread.
Well, there's a very famous burger company in the States called Umami Burger that uses kombu in their burgers because it just combined with meat somehow it has a double whammy impact.
Yeah, exactly. In Denmark, there's this company called Tulip. They make most ham and bacon and so on in Denmark. And they have developed a ham with 10% of seaweed in. You should also taste this one. This is the red seaweed. We grow in that too. That's the Palmaria.
So it's a different species, different type of kombu or different...
It's actually not kombu. It's the English name is Dulce.
Dulce, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. A little bit oystery flavour.
Yes, it's much more fishy.
Mm.
Yeah.
So, Rasmus, how did you get into farming seaweed?
Well, we started out being mussel farmer. So this was we had a certain way of doing mussels on long lines, and we found this technique was more superior to the technique that they are using in Asia. So that was the idea about inventing seaweed production in Denmark, but, you know, with another, you know, setup than we are used to see in Asia. And we did so. That's 2007, started out with the first trials.
But why did you go from mussels to seaweed?
You know, one reason was to have an extra crop, not to be depending on one crop alone. And later on, it also turned out that the business of mussel declined in Denmark for some years. And that was also the time that I more or less skipped the mussels and was concentrating on growing seaweed.
And what was the biggest challenge starting up? Because you actually grow the seaweed out in the sea, right? That seems quite a technical challenge.
Well, that part was quite easy because we had that technical knowledge already doing the mussel farming. But everything else, more or less, because we had to find out everything about the biology in seaweed growing. We had to find out how the hatching of seaweed worked out. And, of course, we stumbled over a lot of problems, and we have to solve them one by one.
Is there anyone else doing this in Denmark or Europe?
Well, we are actually the only one in Denmark. We have a cooperation with fish farmers so that they take some seaweed too and place on lines next to their fish cages and so on. We have our own. So it's a combination of different people working with that in Denmark. But we are the only one, you know, producing the seaweed and also sell the seaweed and this. And as far as I know, we should also be the only company in Europe that does this on a commercial scale.
And how is the demand? I mean, how's business? Do people want your seaweed?
There's a huge interest in seaweed for human consumptions. It's actually overwhelming.
What are people using it for?
For pesto, for bread, for meatballs, whatever comes along.
I know the Japanese claim it's one of the reasons they live so long is because they eat so much seaweed.
Yes, it's a very interesting topic, and there have been written books about that. Very interesting thing. But the most interesting thing, I think, about seaweed is the fact that it has some carbohydrates that you're not used to as a human being to digest. You don't have the starch, you don't have the sugars. You have other kinds of sugars, and then you also have another kind of starch, and you have the alginate. That's also a totally different carbohydrate structure. And this means that in the digestion, it's something, it's like fibers. It's not easy to digest for you as a human, which means that it helps your digestion tract to improve. It helps to develop probiotic bacteria in your digestion tract. And that's the main thing. You have a far better digestion, and that also prohibits a lot of diseases like cancers and so. And that's, I think, the most interesting part. Noma, the quite famous restaurant in Denmark, has been working on extracting the umami from seaweed directly. They put it in bags and heat it a little bit, and then after 24 hours, you can take out the water, evaporate the water, and then you have this fine powder.
And what do the locals make of you? Have you had any reaction here? You're in quite a fairly conservative part of Denmark, you could say.
Fantastic, actually. Yeah, it's overwhelming because everyone nowadays relates seaweed to something that you can eat and you're supposed to eat. And that's a very surprising thing. Just going 10 years back, it was considered something disgusting lying on the beaches. And when I'm now on the beaches collecting seaweed or whatever I'm doing, I cannot walk on a seaweed on a beach without picking up seaweed. It just lies in my hands. People, even older people, elderly people, say, "Oh, you're going to eat that tonight?" And say, "Yes, I'm actually doing that."
That was Michael Booth there, reporting from Denmark for this week's edition of The Menu, which airs this evening, Georgina, at 1900 hours London time, 1400 hours in the afternoon if you happen to be in New York City. And that seaweed did sound pretty yummy.
It did sound good, but I can't quite get rid of the image of you grazing on a beach, Phil, now that you've put it there.
I don't like the seaweed that's too fishy, as you heard Michael saying.
Yeah, well, listen, in a moment we're going to review the international front pages because we've had our Monocle party this week and a lot of our bureau chiefs are back in town. Uh-oh. Aisha Spears is back in town. But first we're going to indulge in a spot of Christmas music. Elvis Presley, because Santa Claus also is back in town. Elvis Presley there, and Santa Claus is back in town. Well, it looks like Elvis Presley himself may also be back because there's a young guy from Quebec, an Elvis impersonator who's just been discovered at a talent show, and he's making headlines all over the world. Phil, have you had a chance to have a look at him?
I have. He's just, 16 years old, you were saying?
Yeah.
It's pretty young. It's the resemblance is quite uncanny.
Well, and his voice, too. I mean, his voice is absolutely spot on.
I don't know if you're kind of pigeonholing the rest of your future career as an Elvis impersonator.
Which they do have pretty funny reputations, don't they? But he looks like he might be a step up from just an impersonator.
I feel like he might want to aim a bit higher.
The return of the king, people are saying. Girls are screaming and crying and throwing their knickers at him. It's all fabulous, apparently, if you're him.
You know? Return of the queen, perhaps? Can we say that? It's Monocle's Aisha Spears, our Hong Kong bureau chief, who graces us with her presence here in the studio in London. How are you?
I'm good. I'm only here because you're here, Phil Hahn.
Have you recovered from the Christmas party on Monday?
I think I should be asking that of you, no?
I was very well behaved, actually. not usually I'm not, but I think on Monday I was.
I think you were really well behaved. There was no Elvis impersonation coming out of you.
No. No.
That could be a possible career option.
Well, you've got some of the international front pages for us this morning.
I do. Slightly less exciting than a teenage Elvis impersonator. But I think the British aristocracy could perhaps be a little bit worried about the Chinese money that is clearly flowing into London real estate. Apparently, tycoons from China have come from nowhere to top the list of the UK's wealthiest property investors. This is on the front page of the South China Morning Post, my daily read over in Hong Kong. And so that ends the Duke of Westminster's 10-year reign at the number one spot. The two men who are being kind of picked out, China's richest man, Wang Jianlin of the Dalian Wonder Group, who topped the 2013 Estates Gazette Rich List, which is apparently a 155-year-old magazine that's been compiling this list, with an estimated fortune of £10.4 billion, and then followed by New World Development's chairman, Henry Cheng. And New World Development is a Hong Kong company. We've spoken to Henry's son, Adrian, in the magazine, and they are in at £10.2 billion.
It's quite a surprising number, isn't it? Because when you think of foreign investors in London, you automatically think of the Russians or the Qataris. But many people don't really relate the Chinese as being huge investors. But I guess these figures prove otherwise.
Well, I think what this article is saying is that it's all these iconic buildings, which the Chinese know exist, want to get involved. And if you look at a group like New World, just in itself, they own so many hotel groups. They own the Rosewood Group. They own the Lanesborough here. Mm. They're expanding all of these kind of things across the world. It's a kind of scale of investment and money, which I think is quite hard to comprehend in Europe anymore.
And is it done just purely as investment, or do Chinese people want to come and actually live here?
I think it's both. I think you've got a question of people wanting to send their kids to school here for university. And I think you, there's also a level of pride at being able to buy a beautiful building in Knightsbridge and show that that is Chinese money, that there's the changing face of Chinese money, which I think Europe needs to kind of get its head around.
The Russian oligarchs should watch their backs because there could be some Chinese investors on their tail.
Indeed.
You've got another story for us today, and it's about Obama and the ever-changing NSA scandal.
Indeed. So from Russian oligarchs to Obama and the NSA. this story was a big story yesterday. The 46-point list of recommendations from an independent committee kind of advising Obama on what he should do with regards to NSA surveillance. We've now seen a little bit of response to that. James Lewis, who's the cyber expert at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, has said to the International New York Times that it's a really bad idea, that they'd be the only country in the world to knock themselves out of the market. Even President Putin said on Thursday that such surveillance was necessary. So all of these bits of advice that Obama is getting from a report he commissioned himself following the Snowden fallout seems to suggest that he will follow through. The public in the US will definitely ask for them, but a lot of people will be thinking it's a bad idea for the Americans.
Aisha, let's finally go on to North Korea and Dennis Rodman, who says that he won't be an ambassador. He is going to go there, but he's not taking any messages. He doesn't want to be responsible.
Who doesn't love Dennis Rodman? I mean, you've got to love the guy. The guy has such... He actually was an amazing basketball player, but I think that it's all been overshadowed by the face piercings, getting married to Carmen Electra.
That was part of his character, wasn't it?
Exactly. But now he's gone from marrying a kind of MTV VJ pop-up to being Kim Jong-un's best friend. I don't know if it's a good idea for him to do this kind of thing. I don't think anyone's really taking him that seriously. It actually makes the whole thing look like a farce, really, in my mind. But at least it draws attention to perhaps people who don't think about North Korea. They're seeing their favorite former basketball player go. They want to know what's happening.
And when you're in Hong Kong and reading the South China Morning Post, and you see these stories about Rodman in North Korea, do the Chinese press just kind of laugh at the whole situation?
I don't think they really get it. It's not really something which, I mean, it's such an American thing. Mm. I think that when I was in the States covering it, you just kind of understood because the whole way that America looks at these kind of things, there's a level of farce even in the way they present their news on many networks. So I think that it works from an American point of view. From a Chinese point of view, I think it's just a bit amusing.
Quite extraordinary.
And Aisha, just a couple of days away from Christmas, are you excited?
I'm very excited.
Do you have all your presents picked out?
I have not got a single present picked out.
Have you been naughty or good?
I don't know, Phil. I might have to talk to you about that later.
Yeah. Aisha, I think you're doing something very exciting this year though, aren't you?
I am. Oh, I am.
What are you doing?
I'm getting married.
That's
almost
so
forgot.
Fabulous. When's that going to be?
I'm engaged.
Next September, I'll be getting married in France, actually. So I have to... Actually, that's what my plan is for holidays, to sort that out.
Well, you heard it here first. I'm looking forward to my invitation. And if I don't get one, I'll be very upset. Aisha, thanks very much for coming on the program, though. Unfortunately, that is all the time we have for today. And that's it for Midori House as well. From January onwards, a new programming schedule. We'll see Midori House back at its original time slot of 1800 hours London time. Tune in from the 6th of January to hear that and the rest of the new and improved lineup here on Monocle 24. Thanks to our producer, Ala John, our researchers, Fernando Acosta Pacheco and Diona McLaren, and our studio manager, Bill Luti. But for me, Phil Hahn.
And me, Georgina Godwin. Thanks
Merry
for
Christmas.
Listening. Bye-bye.
Why this watch? This watch is a witness. A witness to words that moved nations. It's dead men faster, further. It's been worn by luminaries, visionaries, champions. It doesn't just tell time. It tells history. Rolex.